Nope.
Oops.
Welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Up Publicity, as my co-host. And good evening, everyone. And I have to apologize for our bumper music. That was not the Shattered Lives theme song. I guess something went awry there. But we're just trying to keep you all on your toes. So, again, I apologize, but we will make sure we have the right music next time. Oh well.
I thought it was a little bit sexy for your show, Donna.
Okay. Should we do sexy, Delilah? Okay, well, that's good. Let's just roll with it, as they say,
We always do.
Go to the videotape or whatever. So, in any case, enough levity. We have, although we're going to have a lot of fun with this guest, we've been awaiting her arrival. We had a little bit of a glitch last Saturday, but we are with her live and in person now, and I am so pleased to welcome Jennifer Bishop Jenkins from the Chicago, Illinois area, who is an advocate extraordinaire, and her one of her direct callings is her affiliation is director of Marcy's Law in Illinois, and she has so many affiliations and accomplishments. We could take the whole hour, Delilah. But I think we're going to touch on her personal story. She is a homicide survivor from the early 1990s when her sister and her brother-in-law and I guess would be to-be niece were killed. From that point on, life changed. So why don't we bring her in and have her enlighten us on this and the many other issues, particularly Marcy's Law and other things that led from that. So, Jennifer, without further ado, let me say thank you so much for coming this evening. It's a pleasure to have you on Shattered Lives.
Thank you, Donna, and thank you, Delilah. I'm a big fan of the wonderful work you are doing to put out for much more enlightenment what crime victims go through, and I think a very significant community that exists in our nation because of crime and the victimization issues that occur. And so thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you. Coming from you, that's a high compliment because I think it's a mutual admiration society here. And I just have to let people in on the secret. This is not the first time that we have met. I had the extreme pleasure of spending some time with you, although you're a very busy lady, and I certainly was too, but we both were at the National Organization for Victim Assistance Conference in Columbus, Ohio, and it was just such a rewarding experience, and it was such a pleasure to spend a little time with you and your husband, Bill. So I just want to say that from the get-go.
Bill and I are such hardcore attendees of the NOVA conference, Donna, that he and I honeymooned at the NOVA conference.
You're kidding,
11 years ago, that's where we went on our honeymoon.
Wow. Well, what does that say, ladies and gents? Huh? A trooper here. And So, in any case, why don't we start from the beginning, as they say, and something in particular, we a lot of our show has to do with telling a compelling story, and yours is that, a compelling story, and then perhaps getting to Marcy's Law so that people understand that, and then some of the other provocative issues, shall we say, okay?
Sure. My sister Nancy Bishop Langard and her husband Richard and their unborn child were murdered in Winnetka, Illinois in 1990. And mm-hmm. that was it's a very wealthy, prosperous suburb. It was obviously a huge news story because, you know, this is one of those communities where murders don't happen. To make it worse, the killer was a high school student, 16 years old, almost 17, who lived in a $3 million house, went to a top high school, had good grades, had a very prominent family, had a promising future. But because he was smart, rich, advantaged young man, but he was bored. He was bored, and he found he developed into, you know, I think the term is sociopath, someone who actually gets a rush out of breaking the rules and the laws. He was just completely he objectifies everything as a source of entertainment for himself, and ultimately developed intrigue for people who were committed crimes, and he began to read about, you know, like Leopold and Loeb, who committed supposedly the perfect crime, and Charles Manson and people like that, and he emulated that, and also was fascinated with guns and decided he wanted to see what it would feel like to shoot someone. So he snuck out of his house on a Saturday night, all dressed in black, crossed over. He lived right catty-corner from a police station. He walked through the Winnetka police station grounds and went directly across the street to the house right in front of the police station, which was my sister's townhouse. We believe he picked them at random because of the proximity of their home to the police station, as if to say, look what I can do right under your nose and get away with it.
Right.
When he went into the townhouse, he took them. He had stolen a gun. He took them down into the basement at gunpoint, and when they reached the bottom of the stairs, he holding a .357 Magnum point blank to the back of my brother-in-law Richard's head, he pulled the trigger and quite literally blew his brains out. It was execution style, and what was left was not anything that resembled a human head. And I just have to, I have to think about, you know, how Nancy saw that, had to see that happen in front of her, and then collapsed to the floor crying and begging for the life of her unborn child, holding her arms over her pregnant belly. This beautiful 25-year-old who is just the most dear, sweet, you know, life-living, you know, affectionate, harmless person who is, so excited about her having a child and their lives together that were just beginning. And he turned and pointed the gun on her as she begged for the life of her unborn child. She crossed her arms over her pregnant belly and begged for the life of her baby. And if you can imagine the mindset of this, of a person that could do this, he pointed the gun directly at her abdomen and fired. Actually, during the autopsy, we found that the bullet actually hit the fetus and exploded it. We couldn't find the gender of the child, even though that we wanted to bury the baby with its name, but we couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
This was before DNA, and they didn't have any way of telling, except to look to see what gender the baby was, and we found that the baby had actually been hit. Nancy bled to death on the basement floor. The killer fled. We know from evidence that she lived about 20 minutes, maybe 15, 20 minutes, after she was shot, but she was paralyzed. And the last thing she did before she died was she pulled herself over by her husband, and with her hand in her own blood, she drew a heart and a U, love you. Those were her last words.
Wow.
That's what she did right before she died. And those dying words of hers, that she died literally telling us that she loved us and telling her husband that she loved him, and she would always sign her name with that little heart and that little U. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was so...
It speaks volumes, doesn't it?
It does. It
doesn't
does. It just changed everything for me.
Oh, my goodness. And just the heinousness of this, you know, cold-blooded killer. And I just, you know, I can't fathom how someone could do that. And how long was it before they were actually discovered, Jennifer?
They were discovered the next day by my father, who we were trying to, they were something that we were supposed to get together for, and they didn't show up. And so my father called and there was nobody there. He swung by. He saw the cars out front. He couldn't figure out why they weren't there. So he went in, and that's when he found their bodies. And obviously it was just, you know, a life-changing event. I'd had a very nondescript, I was married and a high school teacher and just had a life of my own, very normal life. I had no idea that this kind of thing ever really happened to people. I read about it in the newspapers. Crime in the whole criminal justice system just was not real to me. It wasn't an issue to me. It was just never had come up in my entire life. Nothing like this had ever happened to me before. And it was so, you know, it wasn't just about me. Obviously, it was about everybody in our family and everybody that Nancy and Richard loved and that loved them. And it was just a stunning, life-changing, you know, watershed moment.
It's more into your experience, like all of us, right? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't imagine, you know, having to deal with that situation. And, I mean, ultimately, he planned and plotted, and it was truly right across the street, and he wasn't just this killer obviously must have had a very high IQ, and yeah, like you said, all kinds of time on his hands, and just, I don't know. So if we fast forward to, well, did it take a long time to come to trial, and what was the outcome there for the benefit of our listeners?
Yeah, no, we actually did not know who did this crime for 6 months, which at the time just doesn't seem that long to say that now, but at the time it felt interminable in terms of, you know, not knowing who did this and trying to solve the crime and the massive investigation. But in the end, the young man bragged about it at school and ultimately was caught that way. And he was tried, found guilty, and was sentenced to 3 life without parole sentences in the Illinois Department of Corrections as an adult, because he was only 4 weeks away from adult criminal age in Illinois anyway. And given the seriousness of the crime, there was no question that he would be transferred to and tried as an adult. And, you know, he didn't have any of the juvenile characteristics that you sometimes see with a juvenile offender. He was mature. He was intelligent. He was well-advantaged. He acted alone. He planned it for weeks, maybe even months in advance. He knew exactly what he was doing. He went through great machinations to steal a gun, to dress up like all in black, like an assassin. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he bragged about it afterwards, laughed about it, promised planned actually another mass murder. He planned to go into a local bank and kill a lot of people, and he had already tried to kill his own parents with poison in their home. And so he was clearly...
Oh, you know, that's
my goodness.
That's a kind of a question I think that comes to mind for a lot of people and our listeners probably as well, is where were the parents? And, you know, after what you just said, that he tried to poison them, obviously they were probably super scared to have him in the house. But, you know, it leads me to another question,
Jennifer.
They
were in denial. They were in denial.
Yeah. And how, you know, going through something like this with your own child doing such a horrendous, horrendous thing, how does the victim's family look at the perpetrator's family?
You know, this is a really difficult thing this case, because my father and mother knew these people. They were neighbors, and my father had done some business with the killer's father. And it was difficult for them. Obviously, the night of his arrest, they called and apologized, although they never got to speak to my parents directly. They spoke to me because my parents were busy. But, you know, they had to, I can just say that from the point of view of their family, this killed the mother. She had been struggling with breast cancer. She was dead within 2 years of the crime. She died of breast cancer.
It has the earmarks of, you know, Klebold and all the, you know, and Columbine, it sounds like, in terms of a lot of the modus operandi and what they were doing or what he was doing, the same thing with Columbine, just sends chills down the...
You know, it's really interesting that you would evoke Columbine, because actually my sister's murderer in 1990 was wearing a black trench coat when he killed Nancy and Richard, and that whole idea of the black trench coat mafia that was in the Columbine shooters, we think that he probably, that they were copycatting my sister's killer, because Columbine didn't happen until, what, 98, I guess, 99.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Wow. What a coincidence or whatever. Just incredible. But, you know, people are probably thinking, and you know better, and that's why I want you to address this, is that, oh, well, that's such an anomaly. Somebody that young maybe wouldn't be that heinous. And how they are looked upon in terms of legislatively and all of these other organizations, because did you actually tell us what the age was in terms of child versus adult in Illinois?
Yeah, I mean, most places the line between juvenile and adult is 18, but in many states it's 17 or 16, sometimes in 18, 19, 20, 21, depending on what the definition of the crime and the situation is. Sometimes offenders can stay in the juvenile system until 21. It just varies with the situation and with the state. But in Illinois at that time, 17 was criminal adult age, and he was only 4 weeks away from that. So in all places around the world, and certainly throughout the United States, if you are below a certain age, like 13-ish, 13, 14-ish, you are always tried as a juvenile. If you are above a certain age, like 18, you're always tried as an adult. But there's around the world,
there's
these middle years between, you know, post-puberty and adulthood, where you are tried as a juvenile or as an adult, depending on the situation, depending on the crime, depending on the seriousness of the offense, and depending on the demonstrated culpability of the offender. And in this case, our guy had a previous criminal record. He had clearly, you know, not acted impulsively or, not, you know, he knew what he was doing. It was very heinous. So he was tried, no question, as an adult. He was only 4 weeks away from being an adult anyway. So.
What brought the realization to you that, you know, this perpetrator was somebody or those like them should not be considered, these poor children and we should protect them at all costs, without really looking at their backgrounds? And also, what we want to get into, and I know you want to tell us about Marcy's Law, I believe, is that, you know, they are not, they don't consider the crime victim's family in any way with regard to what they will do with these people.
You raise a really difficult question. How do you determine who amongst our population in general, certainly amongst our young, our troubled youth, is truly, truly dangerous? And, you know, we have to use good information. We have to look case by case. And, you know, thankfully, I mean, really, I truly mean this. I love children. I've been teaching high school students all my life. I have teenagers of my own. We all have made mistakes when we were young. Certainly, we make lots of mistakes. We all get that the juvenile justice system should be a separate system, that most juvenile offenders are people who just screwed up for whatever reason, and they can be helped, and they can be fixed and made better, and hopefully still live productive lives as adults. I'm certainly not one that, you know, wants to throw the book at any kid who dares to make a mistake. That's absolutely not my position.
Right.
I work with troubled youth. I volunteer. I've been volunteering for 15 years with the Cook County Juvenile Probation Department, where I go in and talk to troubled youth and try to help them, you know, realize that, you know, don't go where this kid went. You know, it's very important work that we all should do to help our troubled kids get up back on the straight and narrow. But what we do know, and here's the key, is that a very, very, very small percentage, and I've heard some scientific studies say 3% maybe, of the criminal population are, even at a very early age, psychopaths already, sociopaths or psychopaths. And that means that there's something wrong in their brain, or there's something wrong in their we don't even know what causes, for example, the formation of the conscience. But if a person is a sociopath, a true sociopath or psychopath, and has no conscience, the data, the science is pretty clear. They tend not to ever get one in their lifetime. It's like a switch that, for some whatever reason, is just off with them.
Right.
And if you have somebody who is truly a sociopath or a psychopath or a serial killer in the making, the fact is that sometimes we do see this even among teenagers. And it's rare, and thank God it's rare, and we're talking about an extremely minute portion of the population. Most juvenile offenders absolutely can be helped, can be turned around, no problem, should be helped and should be turned around. But if you're dealing with somebody who is already at the age of 17 a serial killer,
mm-hmm.
and they're already a sociopath or a psychopath, you know, I think that the reason why ultimately I have supported the life sentences that this young man received is because he is never going to be safe to walk among us.
Mm-hmm.
And he's he's around the age of 40 now, close to 40, getting close to 40, and he's certainly not changed in that regard. It's still all about him, and, you know, he's a glory seeker and attention seeker and a manipulator. And so there's just no question that there's lots and lots of data, and there's lots of good risk assessment tools that criminal justice professionals can use now to really sort out who those truly, truly dangerous, heinous people are and who should, in those cases, absolutely be given life without parole sentences. Because why are you going to make victims' families and taxpayers, for that matter, go through the expense and agony and really, for us victims' families, torturous, frequent parole hearings possibly to release somebody who will never qualify for release and never should qualify for release and would never be safe to be released. And again, we're talking about a very small percentage of the population.
The man that killed my father was also a double murderer and a felon of other types too, and should never have come up for parole. So I say never say never, you know, because there's always, you know, depending upon when which laws applied at the time when the crimes were committed and mistakes that are made, in the criminal justice system. But
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
When your father's killer came up for parole, what was that like on you emotionally to go through that parole hearing?
It was awful. It was absolutely horrendous. And I was just saying the other night online, my mother, who just turned 80 years old, and to have her there, I was so proud of what she did in terms of her victim impact statement. But after she finished, she just put her head down and sobbed in her hands. And I had just never seen her like that ever in my whole life. And my heart melted. And she had said, you know, we kept him there for five more years. And she just said in no uncertain terms, I cannot do this again. This is my last time. And you, of course, you can't blame her. And why put anybody through this? So I think your point is very well taken, that, you know, we should not have to go through this. This is a re-victimization, extreme punishment for us as well.
Yeah, what sentencing should factor in when you're dealing with, again, we're not talking about the vast majority of crimes here. We're talking about an extremely narrow percent of cases. Very, very rare where you get, you know, a mass murderer, sociopathic, psychopathic, serial killer, mass murderer, really heinous. You know, most people serving time for murder are not even crimes like that. You know,
mm-hmm.
most murders, I think the average sentence for murder nationwide, time served, is what, 8 years?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of murders are impulsive or, negligent or, sort of just a bad,
have other
bad
disabilities. Yes.
Very few murders are what we're talking about here, which is a
right.
super class of extremely heinous, dangerous, sociopathic, psychopathic people. And so, you know, when we are talking about that small group of people, I just think that the words that we need to keep in mind for victims are is legal finality. Whatever the sentence is, whether it's, you know, a term of years or, you know, life sentence or a death sentence or whatever sentence they receive, the victims' families should not have to endure the constant re-traumatization and literal torture that frequent, regular, ongoing, and unending re-engagement with the legal case of the offender brings to their life.
They
should not
agree.
Have to do that.
I totally agree. So I don't know how do we change that, or but I know you have been advocating very strongly for years on a number of legislative initiatives, and regarding, you know, what happened with your case, and I don't know, would you like to touch on some of that and how things have played
sure.
out?
Sure. I mean, I would say two areas have been my focus since Nancy and Richard and the baby were killed. And that,
uh-huh.
you know, the first is and absolutely the top priority for me, and this is so true for so many victims. I mean, look at what you're doing, Donna. It is to help other people like us, to help
mm-hmm.
other victims, and to work to prevent this kind of thing from happening to anybody else. So I became very focused on violence prevention programs, and I've done that in a number of ways. I've been involved on gun violence prevention. I was actually, after I retired from high school teaching, I became the national program director for victims and survivors for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked locally on a number of initiatives to try to keep, I'm not opposed to people owning guns. I'm not anti-Second Amendment or any kind of, you know, I mean, I know this issue is so contentious.
Right.
But
you're not an extremist.
The bottom line is everybody, including the majority of gun owners. In fact, you know, my husband's a gun owner, and many people are. We all the polling data is clear. I've talked to many, many gun owners. They all agree: background checks, background checks, background checks. You should
right.
not be giving guns to dangerous people. And right now, our background check system is just a nightmare. It's full of loopholes. So
mm-hmm.
I've been very active on trying to help improve the background check system. And one of my, I guess, most important accomplishments was working with many people, obviously not just my accomplishment, but working with a team of victims from the Virginia Tech massacre and the Brady folks and others to get the NICS Improvement Act passed in Congress in 2007, which was actually to help improve the database for background checks, making sure that there was actual assistance to states to make sure that the people who are prohibited purchasers, their names are in the database. And the
mm-hmm.
Virginia Tech massacre, which is, of course, the worst single mass shooting in the history of the United States, had at its core a failure in that regard. The mentally ill young man that shot them, all those people,
mm-hmm.
he was actually a prohibited purchaser. The Virginia State Police had his name, but because of a backlog in entering the name into the database, they had not yet sent it in. They were running with a one-year backlog, and he
wow.
ended up being able to go and buy a gun, passing a background
mm-hmm.
check, because his name wasn't in the database.
Oh, I'm not surprised about that. Well, I think
seems
I need
like
to
there's
give
backlog
the...
in everything. And how do we find
yes.
a solution to this? Not only, you know, with the crime databases, but also the rape kits, and it just goes on and
yeah.
on. And everyone cries funding, but you know, I'm not so sure the answer or the problem really is funding. I'm sure it has a part to play in it, but I really feel like there's got to be more to this situation that we can solve these backlogs. People shouldn't wait 20
years. You
know, when
you think about the money
20
we
years.
Have to spend, the money that we have to spend to prosecute and deal with the violence,
yeah.
the cost of violence in the United States in terms of having to maintain a criminal
yeah.
justice system, courts, jails, prisons,
it's
medical care.
It's astronomical.
It's $100 billion a year. Those figures are from the Centers for Disease Control. $100 billion
with
a
B.
That,
billion,
you know,
billion.
With that money,
so, yes,
people are out of jobs. People, there's no job. You know, people are crying. There's no jobs. Look at all these arenas where we need processing done. I mean, granted, some of them are skilled positions. Maybe some of them are clerical. We need more manpower, people power, in all of these venues to process the rape kits, to process, to maintain the databases, to do this, to do that. But, you know, put these people to work. That's what I say.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think that there's no question that, you know, this is one of those penny-wise, pound-foolish
yes.
type of problems. It, you know, we're unwilling to spend a few pennies to get the right names into the database,
yeah.
But then we're spending, you know, billions to deal with the aftermath of not doing that. So it's just really silly not to be in,
well, where
in
is, you know, speaking of money, where is this money trail leading? You know, I always say follow the money
right.
trail. Well, $100 billion didn't just drop out of somebody's pocket. It had to come from somewhere, and someone along the line here is benefiting from this. So
well,
where
the taxpayers
does
are the taxpayers are the ones footing the bill, but
mm-hmm.
but I assure you the only people benefiting are the multi-billion-dollar a year gun manufacturers who have sunk a great deal of their profits into Congress to make sure that the laws are kept lax, because illegal guns are where their greatest profit come. The, you know, the legal gun market is just not that profitable.
Right.
Guns are very well made. They last a long time. Most people buy one, pass it on from generation to generation. They don't
right.
really go out and buy a lot of guns. And
mm-hmm.
And in fact, it wasn't until the, you know, the average gun homeowner, you know, civilian purchaser, those numbers started declining so dramatically that the gun industry deliberately started consciously lobbying for lax gun laws so that the illegal market would become more lucrative, because they make more money that way. Criminals use a gun once and throw it away.
Right. Right.
Well,
and what about the for-profit prison system that's coming about now?
Yeah,
what are your feelings
scary,
on
it?
That?
Ooh.
I mean, it is. You know, they're
yeah,
they're
I
making
don't think
money
anything
off
like that
of the
should
violence.
Ever be. Yeah, can you imagine what we're, I mean, what are we saying here? We're actually creating an inducement,
yeah.
a financial
mm-hmm.
inducement to incarcerate people when, in fact, you know, I think that over-incarceration is also part of our problem as a society in terms of certainly over-incarcerating for minor nonviolent offenses. Why are we incarcerating people for nonviolent offenses? That's
yeah. warehousing people, yeah. I don't know. There's so many issues to be tackled, and I only hope that the good work that you did with the Virginia Tech people, that our Governor Malloy will take that under advisement, because we've passed some very strong background check laws as a result of Newtown Sandy Hook, Jennifer. And so maybe they will be taking heed of that. It's, you know, I can only hope.
Everybody
know, but,
can agree on background checks. Everybody can agree on that. This is not something
well,
that should divide us.
Yeah, I would hope. But in the mix of all of this, there are many things that divide people. And with respect to, I didn't ask you this earlier when you were telling your story, but what would your sister have wanted with respect to, you know, the outcome of this, and how did she feel about the death penalty or not?
You know, it's not like it was anything we ever discussed,
right.
but I do know that, you know, she loved life, she loved people, she loved children, she would never have wanted her legacy to be more blood, more death.
Mm-hmm.
More vengeance. She was very definitely forgiving and not vengeful. And one of the first things that I did publicly do, and it wasn't like I chose to do this, it just fell in our lap because there was a push after Nancy and Richard were murdered to lower the death penalty age in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was just, what, you know, a few weeks too young, and everybody was like, well, this is outrageous. We should lower the death penalty age because he should be eligible for it. And that was why I was forced to kind of come to terms with the question very quickly, how would I feel about them executing, you know, 17-year-olds, 16-year-olds for extremely heinous murders? And
mm-hmm.
and I, that was really the point at which, let me just say that and I'm sure you can, Donna, understand this, having had a family member murdered, you know how hard it is in those early months to think about what happened to them. I could not bring myself to think about Nancy's final moments, knowing that Nancy was alone on that basement floor, that her baby had been shot in her belly, that she was bleeding out where her baby was. She watched her husband shot execution style. His head was blown off right in front of her. There she was amidst all this blood and destruction, 25 years old, dying, and she only had minutes left, and she knew it. And every time I started to think about what her final 15 minutes were like, I couldn't handle it. I could not go there on my in my mind. I could not go there and think about what would ever move her to write those final words of love as she lay dying, and what that must have been like for her. And it was not until we were forced to, you know, publicly answer this question about how did we feel about the death penalty age being lowered in Illinois to accommodate killers like the one that had murdered her, I immediately went to her on that basement floor in the final moments of her life, the worst thing that could ever happen to anybody, and what were her thoughts? Love.
Love.
What were her words? Love.
Love you.
And I thought, you know, I'm not going to let the Nancy Bishop Langert Memorial legacy be executing juveniles. I'm just not going to, you know, she was about life and love.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, once you've held somebody you love, you know, when you've held a dead body in your arms of somebody that you love, you realize at a very cellular level how wrong it is to kill.
Mm-hmm.
I have held the body of my murdered sister in my arms, and I will never participate in the deliberate death of another human being. I oppose the death penalty. I opposed it because I knew from that moment on how wrong it was to kill and how important it was to focus on preventing violence, preventing the cycles of violence. And so I did come out publicly and oppose the death penalty and didn't, you know, expect that it would be such a huge deal that I had opposed the death penalty, but it did kind of become a big deal.
It did. And for those people who were kind of searching for excuses not to do the evil deed to this heinous killer, they often bring up, you know, their brains aren't really developed, and I know that there's a very good research behind that to debunk that as well, isn't there?
Well, the brain research is not. This is interesting. Now we're getting into the issue of juveniles. At what point does a juvenile criminal become adult culpable for their offenses? And there is, of course, we've known for some years that the frontal lobe of the brain continues to develop well into the late 20s. But remember that people who use this data to try to minimize penalties for juvenile offenders who are very intelligent, like our killer was, who know what's going on, are fully aware of what they're doing, that's actually not a good way to use that research.
Not a good argument.
Here's the deal with the brain. And there's a wonderful article called The Brain on the Stand that was written in the New York Times Magazine some years ago, which I really recommend. And it was written about the work of a man who is wrote an article called, he's actually a legal and neuroscience expert, and the article is Brain Overclaim Syndrome, which is basically this argument that in court you can't hold anybody culpable because the brain isn't fully developed yet. Well, you know, Donna, the brain develops all of our lives, right?
Right.
It changes constantly. Our brains are constantly changing in size, shape, and ability and makeup. Our brain changes all of our lives. We don't stop holding people culpable for crimes at the age in their 50s or 60s because they're more forgetful.
We have no accountability whatsoever using that argument,
exactly.
Correct?
Yeah, using this argument, nobody would be able to be tried as an adult until they're well into their 30s, and nobody would be able to be held accountable if they had any kind of, you know, I mean, you can see the slippery slope with, you know,
right.
Well, my brain made me do it. And in fact, what the sociologists and the criminal and the neurologists are telling us is that the brain is not what commits the crime. It's the whole person. And mm-hmm. we are all developmentally part and parcel of many things, our hormonal systems, our emotional systems, our cognitive abilities, our physical, sexual, social, psychological makeups. All of these things mm-hmm. go together to make us who we are. And to say that just because my frontal lobe is still growing, that I can't be held culpable for something that I knowingly do that is wrong. I mean, we punish 2- and 3-year-old children for you know, minor, I mean, it's minor punishment for minor things,
mm-hmm.
but we guide our children through punishment and reward all their lives. We hold right. children accountable. We make them go sit in the corner. We give them a timeout. We give them consequences. We always manage behavior by holding young people accountable, and we do them a disservice if we don't hold them accountable for things that they do. They will never be given a chance to learn correction. And in fact, my sister's killer is a perfect example. Remember, you were asking earlier about where were the parents. I'll tell you where the parents were. They were busy with their jobs, making money, and neglecting him entirely. And every time he got in trouble, and he did have many other intersections with the law,
mm-hmm.
every time he got in trouble, they just bailed him out, paid off an attorney, paid people off, got him out of trouble, and went back to work and just didn't, you know, they thought that that was the best thing to do is just bail him out, bail him out, bail him out. They never held him accountable.
Yeah.
They never let him be held, and as a result, look what he became. He became
right.
a killer.
Failed and failed, you know, and in those earlier crimes too, then, you know, or they allowed them to pay off people. I mean, it's just, that's, you know, that's even more of a crime because they, you know, the accumulated effect, look what happened. It's just, I don't know, it's incredible. You had mentioned in a lot of the writings that I had read, can you discuss a little bit with regard to the life without parole and sentences being retroactive?
Right. We are facing right now an interesting time in our nation with regards to this small population of juvenile offenders who are who did receive adult life sentences, life without parole sentences. There's about 1,300 of those cases nationwide. Despite the numbers, some of the offender advocates are floating the number 2,500, but that's an estimate that is inaccurate. There's 1,300 cases. It's been counted by attorneys general, and it's been counted by various groups. And these are all people like my sister's killer is one of them, who were under the age of 18 but received a life without parole sentence as an adult because of the extremely heinous level of their crime. And right now that sentence is being revised by the U.S. Supreme Court. They have rendered a couple of decisions. One, that there can't be a juvenile death penalty. Two, that there can't be, in the Graham v. Florida case, that there can't be a life without parole sentence for non-murder for juveniles, like kidnapping. There was only one state that was doing that anyway, and that
yeah.
was Florida. Mm-hmm. And then the third ruling recently, just this last year, Miller v. Alabama, they ruled that life without parole sentences for offenders under the age of 18 can't be mandatory. And so there's a big battle over whether or not this ruling of the Supreme Court is retroactive or not. And that is being battled out in state legislatures and in courts all over the country. We've had most state legislatures and most courts have found that the Miller ruling is not retroactive. The Supreme Court did not say that it was retroactive. But there is one or two, there's a lot of offender advocates that are pushing for it to be applied retroactively, and there's one state Supreme Court that has found it to be retroactive, Iowa. Ultimately, this question of retroactivity may end up back in the U.S. Supreme Court. We are confident that we'll win that because you can't go back in time. There's just lots and lots of legal precedent,
right.
and it gets very technical, but you can't go back in time and recreate due process of law. Just in my case alone, the file has been lost. It's a 23-year-old
mm-hmm.
case. The court can't even find the file. And we just found that out last week, by the way.
Oh, really?
Because our offender is now challenging his sentence under the Supreme Court ruling. And
uh-huh.
we're all waiting now for the Illinois Supreme Court and other Supreme Courts to determine the retroactivity question, but it looks like the vast majority of them that have already ruled have already found that it is not retroactive.
Well,
so I think that that's the way it will go, but in the meantime, chaos for victims. Absolutely.
Well, I'm sure. And to bring it into the realm of what about the other side of the equation, those of us here that have to go through the anguish, you have waged a battle to Marcy's Law. And we've got just a little over 15 minutes, I believe. And why don't you talk about that for us? Tell our audience.
Oh, yes, thank you.
What is Marcy's Law? How did it come about? And what is it that your thrust is currently with respect to what you're trying to do?
Oh, well, thank you so much for talking about this, because this is so important to every crime
it
victim.
Is.
And this is the one thing about Marcy's Law, I hope everybody who's listening to the show will be interested in this, because this is the one topic in crime victim, this is the one topic in public policy, I would say, today, that potentially could apply to absolutely every single person. You know, the civil rights issue doesn't apply to everybody, the LGBT rights doesn't apply to everybody, you know, there's so many issues that don't apply to everybody. They're like special interests. But this is potentially something that could affect literally every person in America, because every person in America is potentially a crime victim. And all that Marcy's Law is an enforcement mechanism to make sure that victims' rights are real, that they have teeth to them, that they can be enforced if there's a violation of them. So let me briefly explain victims' rights. And I'll first start off by saying who Marcy is. Marcy Nicholas was a murder victim in California. She was a beautiful young graduate student at UC Santa Barbara who had an abusive boyfriend. She broke up with him. He threatened to kill himself if she didn't come over one night, so she went over there mistakenly to try to help him, and when she got there, he blew her away with a shotgun.
Yeah.
Literally. Shot her in the face. Horrible murder. He was arrested, obviously, and the family was devastated, and literally within the week when they had just buried her, they had literally just put her in the grave. The family, the Nicholas family, was driving back home from the grave and stopped in the grocery store to pick up some food for company that was visiting them, and there in the grocery store was the killer. Okay? And they're like, how does this guy get out? They called the police up. How does this guy get out without our knowing about it?
Right.
And they call up, and the police say, we are under no obligation to inform victims of the release of the offender on bail. So that's when the Nicholas family said, well, we'll see what we can do about that. And they worked very hard with other victims' rights advocates to pass much stronger protections for crime victims in Illinois. And Marcy's Law became a California constitutional amendment in 2008. And the Nicholas family has been very generous to try to share resources to make sure that it passes in other states as well. And ultimately, the goal is the U.S. Constitution. And what this simply does is, many states have constitutional amendments already in place, 33 states. All 50 states and the federal government all have crime victim protections and rights. But if there's a violation of the rights, there's really no mechanism in most places for those rights to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
The way I liken this is to, when our nation had slavery, and then we had the Civil War, and then we abolished slavery, and African Americans were given the right to vote, at least men were at first, and then later in the 20th century, women were given the right to vote. But then it took all the way up until the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement to make those rights real, to give them teeth. Because, as you know, even though African Americans had a right to vote, all during the early 20th century, they were denied that right through all sorts of tricky means. And so that's kind of what we're finding, is that whereas many places do respect victims' rights, in a lot of places they don't. A lot of places, you know, if they're a little short-staffed and they have to cut a corner and not call a victim up and tell them about the proceeding, then they won't. You know, they won't remind them of they won't notify them, they won't allow them to consult with the prosecutor, they'll do a plea bargain and release the offender really quickly without telling the victim. even if it endangers the victim. And so all we're asking, and what Marcy's Law does, and what we hope will ultimately be in the U.S. Constitution, is a mechanism that allows victims to simply go to the court and say, Your Honor, I wasn't notified of this hearing. Your Honor, please don't accept this plea bargain until I've had an opportunity to make a statement about the case. So what we find is that when law enforcement and prosecutors and defense attorneys and police and courts talk to victims, they learn more about the case. It's just good practice.
Right.
To exclude victims is not only bad for the victims, it's bad for the workings of the criminal justice system.
Jennifer, how easy or difficult is it for, and if I'm using the term that correctly, correct me in your presentation, having that legal standing, how easy is it to get access to the judge to make those kinds of requests?
Well, in the states where we have standing, and let me explain briefly what standing is. Standing in a legal proceeding simply means that you have a right to file a motion. So, for example, the news media, they always have standing in a case. Let's say that there's a high-profile case and the defense team says, let's ban cameras and no media coverage in the courtroom. Let's have a gag order on this trial. The news media has standing to go and file a motion and ask the judge, please allow us freedom of the press to cover this trial.
Uh-huh.
So, witnesses have standing. Anybody who has an interest in the case should have, by law,
standing
ask the court to enforce their rights. But what we're finding is that victims are being denied standing in a lot of places unless it specifically says that they do have standing. So now the states that have enforceable victims' rights, like California with Marcy's Law, Arizona, Oregon, New Jersey, Colorado, Wisconsin, a lot of states have standing already. But many states, like Illinois and others, do not. And there are specifically victims here have been told for years, I know because I work with them every day, have been told for years, you don't have standing, so you can't talk to the court. And so horrible things will happen, and victims will be just told, I'm sorry, there's nothing you can do about it, you don't have standing. So what we want to do is just simply say they do have standing only with regards to their own rights. So they don't have the ability to try to do anything to affect the course of the trial, what happens to the accused, the rights of the accused, rules of evidence, the rules of the proceedings. None of that can the victim can affect. But if the victim is dealing with the matter of their own right to be notified, to make a statement at sentencing, to be present during a proceeding, to be kept safe from threats, to ask for restitution, all of those limited victims' rights, they should be able to talk to the court about them without having to go through the prosecutor or the defense attorney, which are quite often the people violating their rights.
Well, in that matter, I've seen judges where a victim has given the victim impact statement, and in effect, the perpetrator was given 10 extra years because of what the victim had to say when the sentence was essentially predetermined. So I think this still could be a powerful mechanism.
Why would you not want to hear from the victim? That more information.
Because I don't have time and I have too many cases on the docket, Jennifer.
Well,
isn't that what they say?
But then you can't do justice.
You can't do justice
if you don't have all. If you're in such a hurry that you cannot hear from the victim of the crime, that means that you're likely going to make a lot more mistakes. And, of course, we're finding that, aren't we, that the criminal justice system is making mistakes. And one of the things we are seeing in California, as they've made this adjustment now under Marcy's Law to a more enforceable victim's rights, is that better communication is happening earlier in the cases because they are being forced to stop and say, let's talk to the victim. But what that is doing is it's making the system work better with less mistakes down the road.
Right. Well, good. And so they are considered a model state then? Would you say
they're getting
the
Marcy's Law in California is now really a gold standard for victims' rights across the country.
That's one. So what is it that you are doing as the director for
this cause in Illinois. What is it that you're doing currently?
Well, we're working to pass HJRCA1, House Joint Resolution Constitutional Amendment 1, in the 2014 legislative session. And when we get it passed, we almost passed it in 2012, passed both the House and the Senate overwhelmingly, but we had two different versions and we couldn't work out reconciliation in time to get on the ballot. So we have to get on the ballot 6 months in advance of the November election. So we've got until May of 2014 to get on the ballot, and then the Illinois public will vote on it in the November 2014 elections to put that amendment into the Illinois Constitution to give victims an enforcement mechanism if their rights are violated. And we have overwhelming polling data, overwhelming support for it. We have to work out opposition from some of the folks in the legal field that I think are frankly afraid. They're afraid that if they give a victim an enforceable right, that somehow things will change dramatically in how the criminal justice system operates. But all we have to do is look at the states where enforceable victims' rights are already in place to say, no, actually the system isn't falling apart. It's working quite well. Thank you very much.
Right. And isn't there a petition circulating with respect to getting constitutional rights in all these other states? Is that what I saw at the conference?
Get involved in Illinois.
What can we do?
To get involved in Illinois, you go to marcieslawforillinois.org, that website, and you can get involved on our mailing list there. But the national push, the push to get this into the U.S. Constitution, is quite real and quite well advanced, and we already have a constitutional amendment that's been drafted and redrafted and carefully reworked by top legal experts in the country. It's got broad bipartisan support. It's been introduced into the U.S. Congress. So folks want to check out the website NVCAN, which is the National Victims Constitutional Amendment Network, NVCAN.org. And that website will take you to information about the National Constitutional Amendment that will give victims standing in the U.S. Constitution. And if we have time, I'll tell you briefly why it is we don't have victims' rights in the U.S. Constitution. I think a lot of people don't know this, and I used to be a history teacher.
Yeah, please tell us. We've got a couple more minutes.
Good. Okay, so you know the 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution have many, many for the offender. Rights to privacy, unreasonable search and seizure, pleading the fifth, I don't have to indict myself. You have a right to, no cruel or unusual punishment, a speedy trial, a jury of your peers. All of those things protecting the accused, the defendant. The offender has many protections in the U.S. Constitution, but nothing for victims, and here's the reason why. Back in the day when the U.S. Constitution was written, it was the late 1700s. We had just come through a revolutionary war against the British. We were a new nation. And in those days, there was no technology. The population was very small. Most people lived on farms. And the way the criminal justice system worked, there was no professional prosecutors. There was no professional defense attorneys. There were these judges. They call them circuit judges. The reason why we call the judges circuit today is because judges literally used to ride around on a horse from village to village to village to hold legal proceedings. And what would happen is, let's say, Donna, you stole my cow. I, the victim, would be the prosecutor, and you, the defendant, would be also your own defense attorney. And then I would take you before the judge and say, Donna stole my cow, and I would be the prosecutor and you would be the defense. And there was no professional prosecutors. There was no courthouse buildings for the most part. There was no defense attorney, public defenders, all of the bureaucracy that we have today. And so there was never a question that the victim was going to be involved in their case because the victim was the prosecutor. There was no need to build protections for the role of the victim into the case back in those days because the prosecutors were the victims and the victims were the prosecutors. They were present. They were heard from. They were notified, of course. There was no need to do that. And it was only the many years of evolution away from victim involvement in their cases towards a more professionalized, bureaucratized criminal justice system that removed the victim further and further and further away from their cases.
Very interesting historical perspective there. I could hear the history teacher coming out there. Wonderful. No, it really is. It's fascinating. And, our time is vastly slipping away, so I'm saying to you, I want to ask you, with all these witnesses, will you come back someday?
I'd love to.
Oh, that would be great. What would be your parting words to us in terms of your national message?
You know, everybody that's listening to that show is obviously somebody that cares about what happens with public safety and with criminal justice and with crime victims. And so I would urge everybody to call their congressman and urge them to support and sign on to the constitutional amendment for victims' rights that will go into the U.S. Constitution one day, I feel sure. And also check in your state to see if you have an enforcement mechanism in your state. And if not, let's talk about bringing Marcy's Law to your state. There's a website, marcyslawforall.org. And urge...